Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle. Hello and welcome to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor. As always, I'm joined by my fabulous two co-hosts, Peter and Kate. How are you both today?
Really good, Dave. It's great to be joining you too. I love this topic as well.
All is very good here, Dave. I do feel sorry for you and Kate in Melbourne and all those people in New South Wales being in lockdown due to COVID-19. But, things here in South Australia are pretty good, not only COVID-19-wise, but also property-wise, as they are in most of the country.
Yeah, well, look, hopefully Dan's gone hard and gone early and we won't be in it for too long. We'll wait and see. It's certainly... is spreading pretty rapidly early on, and I think it's going to be extended. We're recording this episode on the Monday, the 19th of July, due to come out on Wednesday night, but I don't think that's going to happen. How was your first weekend, Case, from a property perspective, with back into lockdown?
Yeah, we had an interesting weekend. I actually had Zoom auctions and on various platforms as well, not just Zoom, and it was very intensive weekend. Obviously, having imminent lockdown and the chance of an extension, we saw some being brought forward, some being pushed out. But yeah, there was certainly still a lot of buyer activity. I had tough competition for each.
Yeah. I think Melburnians in particular are used to going in and out of lockdowns now. And so the impact on behaviour isn't what it was. And I think I even noticed sort of a more generally relaxed nature with people who I managed to, you know, talk to and bump into during some exercise or going for a walk with the kids. So I think that might be reflected by the activity in the property market. Well, look, rather than do any market updates today, I love today's topic, boom and busts, looking back at what the property market has done from 2003 to 2020. And our resident property professor has produced a superb Excel spreadsheet for us here with the annual price movements of each capital city and then the weighted average of the capital cities. And there's a lot for us to talk through in today's podcast. So how about we just jump into it? And Pete, do you want to set the scene of what you've put together here and what we're going to cover today?
Sure. So the reason I picked 2003, because that was the end of the last national boom that we had, and we're currently going through another national boom. So I thought it'd be good to compare. And I do have data that goes back all the way to 1970, which is like 50 years worth of data. And if we find that lots of people like this episode, then maybe we can go back and try and unpack 50 years worth of property booms and busts. But just looking at it broadly, so 2003 was the best year nationally, and every capital city except for Darwin also had a very good year. So when I say very good, what I've done, if you have a look at the notes, you'll see I've picked the best 3 years and the worst 3 years. So in 2003, every capital city had either their best or second best or third best year. And in 2011, every capital city except Sydney had one of its bad years. And that, for me, I reckon is because that's when all the stimulus money as a result of the GFC was coming out of the market. But the other thing I wanted to point out for all of our Sydney and Melbourne listeners is in 2018, Sydney had its worst year. In 2018, Melbourne had its worst year. Brisbane also had a bad year, but none of the other capital cities had a bad year. But nationally, that was the worst year in this time period, which just goes to show the weighting that's used here by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Because Sydney and Melbourne have the most houses, they put most weight on those two capital cities. So even though most other capital cities did not experience a bad year, because Sydney and Melbourne had 2018 was a very bad year for them, nationally, that was our worst year. So that's just the national perspective, but I think it'd be a good idea, Dave, if we look at each capital city. I'm sure I can talk about Adelaide, you two can talk about Melbourne, I know Kate's got investment property in Hobart. But I think we can give some very good insights to our listeners as to what happened, possibly why it happened, when it happened, so far as these booms and busts are concerned.
That sounds good. All right, so how about we have a bit of a talk through the capital cities' journeys, and then we'll circle back to why did 2003 occur? What occurred in the lead up? What are some of the trends that we can see around the numbers? So, you know, what happens in the booms? What happens in the busts? What is the difference between the booms and the busts? I think there's quite a few things we can cover, mm-hmm. isn't there?
Absolutely.
So, Kate, where would you like to start?
Well, obviously, I got this data from Pete and, you know, opened it up, had a look across all of the figures for any real standout years, and there absolutely were some standout years for varying cities. There was one year that was very, very strong across the board, and I know that we'll talk about that more, but there's one figure that I could barely get my head around, and that was Hobart in 2003. Now, I look at that, and that's such a dramatic figure there. And this is a city that doubled in value in a very, very short space of time. So the obvious question was why? What happened? Mm. What was going on at that time?
So for the listeners, in 2003, Hobart grew by 55.3% is what Kate's alluding to there. And we were just having a chat off air thinking through why might have that occurred. So, Pete, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are 2001 and 2 were terrific years for most of the nation. So if you go back, while I was waiting for us to start recording, I did go back and check out those previous 2 years. And for most capital cities, they actually had double-digit growth in each of those years. That's pretty good. So what happened was, in a nutshell, property prices got too expensive on the mainland. Tasmania or Hobart was still cheap. So a lot of the mainland money went to Hobart. And I think those people that are listening that are from Hobart and remember that time period will remember where there was lots of interstate people, not just buying investment properties there, but many of them, because the boom was so good, were looking to retire or semi-retire. So I think if we match up the population statistics, I mean, I know they only come every 5 years, but I think we'll see a big difference from the previous census, previous to 2003, because mainly it's affordability. That's probably the number one reason. What do you reckon, Kat? You got some investment property there.
Yeah. Look, I think if we look at Hobart and Tasmania in general, we see a lot more volatility in terms of the price movement when these cities and when this state takes off. It has some very obvious runs, and then it has some obvious periods of not doing so much, so it's a bit more stagnant. And that has been a little bit of a hallmark there. And what we do know about Tasmania is jobs aren't abundant down there. And that's been one of the most significant detractors for a lot of people who might have wanted to make the move down there. But back in 2003, it was an enormous run. And I remember, you know, it was a water cooler conversation in the office. And when we compared the property price tags down there at the time, there was a really huge discrepancy between mainland and down there. You could buy bargain properties and some people could pay cash for them. I remember when I was circling in on some parts of Tasmania, not the capital cities, but there were properties available for under $30,000. And so for a lot of people who were looking at the yields and considering getting a little slice of the apple aisle, they could pay cash for it. And as you know, when there's a news story and when there's a headline and when something's going really well, it can attract more people to jump onto it as well.
Yeah, so it was probably a correlation with the bigger picture story of Australians becoming more confident in property as an investment vehicle. And so that awareness picking up over that period of time, people, you know, there was easier access to finance. It was still the early years of mortgage broking. I started our business in 2004 And we were one of the first businesses to have buyer's agents in-house. So the phenomenon of buyer's agents had only just started beginning back then. So this concept of we can put money into real estate and trust it was building. And I think, you know, exactly as you just said, Kate, people turned their eyes and went, okay, we've spent money on mainland Australia. And then they started spotting Hobart and saw the values proportionately were so low and started sending money down there. And because the population is also so low, it obviously had a much bigger impact because there were many factors that led into 2003 having such a strong year. What are some of the reasons for 2003? And a couple of years leading up to 2003 was quite strong, but then 2003 has been our best year ever. But we've got question marks on 2021 because it's going to give it a run for its money.
It certainly will. 2003 ended up nationally at 19.3%. And nationally this year, we could go further. It depends really on the lockdown, I think, in Melbourne and Sydney. That might suppress property prices. But Dave, just before we go back into what caused all of that, do you remember low doc loans and no doc loans?
Look, I sure do, Pete.
So the availability of finance, money was very free. For our very young listeners or the newbie investors, you want to give them a quick overview of what a no-doc or low-doc loan was?
Look, I became a mortgage broker in 1999 as a young 24-year-old whippersnapper, and the prevalence of new products in the early noughties, if you like, over those years, like no-docs, low-docs, was quite astounding. And this was off the back of deregulation of the banking industry. So, you know, a low-doc loan, you didn't have to provide any proof of income. You just had to state what your income was to get a loan. And a no-doc loan, you just didn't have to provide anything. So as long as your asset had a certain value and your LVR was low enough, you could get finance. Now, the one that is always good for a laugh, we didn't have them in Australia, but we in the United States were ninja loans, which stands for no income, no jobs, as long as you've got an asset. So there was definitely one of the reasons for this run was access to finance.
Yeah. And leading up to that, we had a very slow period in the 1990s. We had a recession, and it was worse for Victoria and South Australia because their state banking system went through the ringer. Then late 90s, we had the Howard government brought in the capital gains tax discount of 50% for investors, yep, which was fantastic. But investors were too scared to act on that because at around the same time, it was announced that we were going to have this new tax called a GST, or goods and services tax, brought in on the 1st of July 2000. So really the market, property market, did nothing from mid-99 to mid-2000. And then the housing and building companies complained that there was no activity in the property market because people were too worried about the GST. So the $7,000 first home grant, first home buyer grant came in. That was actually also to offset the GST. And then there was not enough activity in the new home market, so that was doubled. Some states, like in Victoria, they increased it again if you were building in regional areas. So what you've got is a lot of nothing happening in the 90s. Then a trigger for investors who can't act upon it, worried about the GST. 1st of July comes and goes, some government incentives, and then we're off. And a bit like now, like have a look at what happened 2020, early 2021. We had a very short recession due to COVID-19, government incentives, and now we're off again.
Yeah, that correlation between government stimulus, that's definitely there between 2003 and this year, isn't there, off the back of a recession?
So what we had is 2001, 2002, 2003 were terrific years. And as we said, that culminated in Hobart having a huge year because people thought that property prices were too expensive in mainland Australia. But Dave and Kate, if we look closely at the resource states, because you know, in the early noughties is when iron ore started to go crazy and other resources. Perth, so 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 4 years in a row, double-digit increase, and it finished with a 42% increase in 2006. And then we look at Darwin, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 5 years in a row of double-digit growth. Now, unfortunately for both of those cities, because resources haven't done so well, they've dropped, and actually at the moment their property prices aren't as high as they were in the past. They're still going to reach their peak. Kate asked me a question why I thought Adelaide was one of the least volatile cities, and I think it's because it doesn't have those major factors like resources, which can, as we can see here, can do wonders for property, or it can also hurt property. And it's also not like Sydney and Melbourne, where we have a huge influence from overseas investors. They come in with plenty of money. They're happy to pay plenty of money for property. And Brisbane is the other one where surveys have shown that if an investor is not going to buy in their own state, the number one state that they look at is Queensland, in particular, southeast Queensland. So you've got those other capital cities have major influences where Adelaide doesn't. So, for example, if people look at our spreadsheet here, there was only 2 years where Adelaide had double-digit growth, but in its third worst year, property prices were still positive. Like no other capital city shows that. So there's not a lot of magnitude in the Adelaide property booms or busts, if we want to call them busts.
And Pete, would you circle in on population growth and the a more steady rate? What are some of the reasons for that? Because I know that, you know, Adelaide had a little bit of, you know, its share of bad news in the jobs arena when the car manufacturing plant was closed down. And that was a bit of a sad news story, but the data doesn't necessarily reflect anything super negative there in terms of property price movement.
No, look, you know, I've tried to work out, you know, what the property market is similar to. And for me, it's similar to a garden. It's not like a water in a tap. You've got the soil, you've got the sun, you've got the other factors in the climate, you've got the plant itself. There are just so many factors that affect the property market. It's very hard to say, or just because it's, you know, it's being quite wet doesn't mean that the garden's not going to do well, because there might be other factors that help the garden do well. Like lots of days of sunshine might help to draw out the soil. So I would come up with a better analogy, but I'm the world's worst gardener. But what I'm trying to point out is there are so many factors that go into the property market. It's very hard to say just because this happened, this will happen. Except as we were saying before, government stimulus has a huge impact. And it's been shown this time around, shown in 2001, 2 and 3, shown straight after the GFC, and also when we were buying our first house back in the 80s, how much of an impact that had on property prices.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
You've touched on a fair bit there, Pete, which is great. I mean, if we look at some of the things that jump out for our listeners, if they don't have the Excel in front of them, Perth, 4 years in a row, 19.9, 13.2, 22.7, as you mentioned, 42% growth in the fourth year there. Darwin, although it wasn't in its top 3 years in 2003, still grew at 14.5% in 2003. 14%, 20%, 18%, 11%. But obviously, they've gone backwards significantly and still aren't at the level they were at in those years. So they went off the back of the property boom leading into 2003 and then the resources boom. So they had that sort of double whammy, which they just haven't been able to recover from since then, which is actually what's happening now, isn't it? We're having the resources boom as well as the recovery off the back of a recession. So, Kate, is there any sort of takeouts from what Pete's just talked us through that you'd like to narrow in on or something different?
I think lots of really good, valid points for where things were in 2003 and why we've seen some outperformance years. What we've got right now, though, that we didn't have during these strong boom years are super low interest rates. And I think that given that we've come, well, we're still grappling with the pandemic, but we've got, as you've just said, Dave, a lot of positive drivers that could continue to keep things moving. We've also got super low interest rates, and I don't think we've seen the end of that yet.
So it's interesting. We've never had interest rates this low, but I don't think this boom will be as good as it was in 2001, 2 and 3. So, again, interest rates is one of those things, you know, that property garden, it certainly factors into it, as do many other things, but it's just, yeah, I mean, there are scholars that study the property market and still haven't worked out exactly what's happening because, as I said in a few episodes previous to this, you've also got to understand the psychology of the consumer, because the property market is not dominated by investors, not like the share market. Property for most people is a home. It's not an investment property or a rental property. So you've also got to factor in consumer confidence into the equation.
So one thing which we touched on in our last episode in 2003 was the year that had the greatest supply of the sale of properties.
Yes, I remember you said that,
Yeah, on record. And the reason for that was because it was the last year the baby boomers upgraded. So en masse, the biggest cohort of property-owning Australians decided to upgrade their homes during that year. So that obviously was a big catalyst for growth in values that year. And then it also made it easier for those coming underneath, first-time buyers who had the greatest stimulus that they'd ever received, to then go and buy a lot of the properties that the baby boomers had moved out of as well. So that was another factor that fed into 2003.
To have a lot of sales, you would have a lot of supply, whereas that's different this time. One of the reasons property prices are going up so much is because there is a lack of supply. I don't think we saw this, but Kate, you might be able to correct me because you're our champion in the regional areas. This time around, the regional areas are going nuts. Is that what happened back in 2001, 2 and 3, 4, Kate? Do you remember?
I wish I did. And I was an active property investor then, but I wasn't an advocate then. And I wasn't looking closely enough at the data to know exactly what the regions were doing. So I don't recall our regions having a run like they are now. What we know is that COVID has really exacerbated some of that as well, because we did see a lot of people escaping to the country.
Certainly, yeah. Certainly for lifestyle reasons. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to point out to our listeners is we're talking about booms and busts, but the magnitude of the booms are much bigger than the magnitude of the busts. In other words, prices go much higher during a boom than they move lower in a bust. So just to give you an example, if we forget about Hobart and Perth because they're extraordinary booms, but if we go to Sydney, its best year was 16%. But its worst year was minus 8%. In Melbourne, its best year was 23%. Its worst year was minus 7.6%. In Brisbane, its best year was 39%. Its worst year was only minus 5%. So you can see consistently, boom years often have double-digit growth, whereas bust years, if we want to use that term, it's still only single-digit. So it's a pretty safe bet if you're investing in property, unlike, say, if you're going to invest in the share market where you can have some huge increases but also some huge decreases.
And you can note that the boom, the best year of every capital city except for two, was in excess of 20%.
Yeah.
Now, another interesting statistic that I found leading up to 2003, which I don't think any of us really know for certain how much this impacts property values, was in the 18 years from 84 to 85 to 02, 03, as we became wealthier, we increased the average floor area of our new houses by 50%. So we're actually buying bigger houses, significantly bigger houses. Now, what we know has also happened during COVID is people have invested in the footprint of their house increasing as well. And we've moved from being just the second largest houses back to the largest houses in the world on average above the US over the last 6 to 12 months. Like, and this is another good example of how the anomalies of trying to unpack property data and how, you know, medians read what the algorithm or, you know, the formula is for determining the median, but, you know, how does the size of the dwelling increasing actually impact the median values increasing. We don't know.
So there have been some studies on that, but yeah. The other thing is it's not just the building size that improves, it's the building quality. You know, back in the 70s, people were happy to have just the basic shell of a house, and then they'd add the carpet when they could afford it, and then they'd add the curtains, and then the air conditioning. Today, that's all going to be in. They're just givens. So our houses are not only bigger today, they are also of a higher quality, which if everything else stays the same, you would expect that property prices would go up anyway. So we can see nationally that property prices are greatly affected by what the federal government does. You know, first homeowner grants. Back in 2008, we also had other stimulus. Remember the pink bats? There was building, like every school was going to get a hall or a lab. So that it created employment, which then creates, you know, people with more money.
Post the global financial crisis we're now talking about now. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and as much as I've been looking at the property market and studying it, I still can't put my finger on why certain cities take off when they do. I mean, for Perth and Darwin, we can look back and say, yes, that's what happened. All right. I think in more recent times, I could see that when the federal government again, when the federal government brought in an impost for overseas investors, so they had to pay an extra, I think, 7% if they bought property, that slowed down the property market. And that's exactly the reason that they brought it in, to slow down the property market.
Yeah. 2011.
Yeah. But then there are other factors. I mean, I live in Adelaide and I still can't work out why Adelaide does so well when it does. And it's not necessarily population growth, because it's the people that are buying the property, and often people that buy property don't live there. You'll have a look at some of our beautiful regional areas where people go and buy holiday houses. Like Byron Bay is very expensive, right? Hugely expensive. But it doesn't have the same sort of population as other places around Australia. Look what happened during COVID-19. Nobody came in from overseas. No net increase really in population in Australia, but still property prices go crazy. So again, it's that property garden with so many different things affecting it.
And what do you put down to legislative changes and policies and incentives and state-based offerings? Have you got any evidence there of something that South Australia have done that have delivered a particular result, Pete?
Well, you would think, like, if federally the government says, like now, right, $15,000, well, we did have $15,000 first home owner grant. $15,000 is going to go a lot further in Adelaide than it is in Sydney. So you would think places like Adelaide and maybe Darwin, which it has, will go crazy. But Adelaide didn't really go that crazy. So you've got to also remember, unlike first home owners grants of the previous century, geez, that sounds like a long time ago, doesn't it? I mean, like the 1900s, 1980, 1990, back then, first-time owner grants for all property, established and new. But now first-time owner grants are only for new property. And generally new property is only 2% of the whole market. So first-time owner grants may not have as big an effect on the property market today as they did 30, 40 years ago. There are many other factors. The other thing, back in the 70s and 80s, investors did not have as big an impact. Because as Dave was saying, in the 90s is when we have the evolution of mortgage brokers. So people could go not just to their own bank or maybe one other place to find money, but they could have mortgage brokers check out 20 or 30 different places. They got the cheapest loan that they could or the best loan that they could, and then that encouraged them to buy.
Yeah.
So investors played a bigger role in the property market in more recent times. And in my dad's time, there was no going to the bank to borrow money for property. You had to go and find some wealthy individual who would lend you the money. So the deregulation of the banking system also helped, as well as the introduction of mortgage brokers to bring in more property investors into the market. So the landscape has changed. Like you were saying, Dave, it's very hard to compare, say, property prices today with what it was 40 years ago, because properties on average today are bigger and they're also of a higher quality. So very interesting, very interesting.
Now, there is something about the boom and bust cycles that I think would be relevant to share with our listeners. And at the coalface, I think recognising the hallmarks and understanding how negotiations and campaigns change, how agents pivot, how vendors and buyers behave would be really exciting to talk through.
Kate, and you'd be the best person to chat about that, but just my own experience, like a house goes on the market on the Thursday, first open is on the Saturday, all offers need to be in by the Monday. Mate, the deal is done within 7 days. Don't even bother going to auction, which is a 3 or 4 week campaign. It's all happened within a week. It's just phenomenal.
Days on market, it's a really good measure. It's not the only measure, but in a non-auction-centric market, it's a very, very good measure.
Like bus, you'd get agents continually ringing you, oh, I've got this property for sale, I've got this property for sale. But no agents have rung me for the last 6 months because there's no point. They've got lineups outside open inspections, people ringing in from interstate to buy. You just don't even get a chance. Even though our property prices may not go as high as they did back in 2003, I mean, I was quite an active investor back in 2001, 2 and 3. It was not like this. I did not see it where many properties would be done and dusted within a week. Just phenomenal. Absolutely.
And, Kate, how do agency practices change in relation to how sales are facilitated? We're touching on that a bit here and tactics that are employed. Did you want to dive into that a little bit further?
Yeah, for sure. Let's say that we've got a market that's moving from balance to a seller's market, so a hot market, like what we're in now. As things start to heat up, you've got agents that are noticing sale prices are eclipsing expectations. That's when you've got a market that's on the run. You start to get vendors that go from being pleasantly surprised to expecting a great result. That's when a market gets really hot. You'll have vendors who have seen other vendors around them achieving great results and they've got an expectation. So catching that particular wave can be hard for agents because at the beginning of a run, you're delivering something really exciting. You've got good news stories and you've got vendors that love you. And as the run starts to become the norm, you've got vendors that expect you to deliver that amazing result each time. And at some point when it's about to tip or when, you know, vendor greed is stronger than what's likely to happen, the agents then got to be able to have honest conversations with the vendor and manage their expectations. And that's difficult. And for the buyers, they're in a situation where for the agent to represent the vendor well, they'll create as much competition as they can. It might mean that they're pushing out an auction date or having a really exciting campaign where they're not accepting earlier offers. They're wanting to have their day in the sun. So they're all the hallmarks of a hot seller's market. But when things start to shift, and sometimes they shift quickly, if we cast our mind back to the 2019 downturn that we all experienced and sort of pivoted after the federal election result, that market was very different. Agents were encouraging prior offers, or trying to pull deals together beforehand. They were a lot more flexible with buyers. We even had situations where we could put in offers that were subject to finance because agents knew that they had limited buyer activity and very nervous buyers. So the hallmarks of the negotiating and the way that campaigns are tackled are completely different when you're in a turning market and when you're in a hot market or a really difficult market.
Yeah, so there's significant differences, aren't there, between that, for our listeners to look out for and be aware of and to have to navigate when they're buying property.
And as Pete said, that best and highest offer and you've got a particular time of day to deliver your offer, that's a hallmark of a hot seller's market.
Yeah.
Very much so, because they're really preying on people's willingness to have that huge jolt of FOMO and to put in their best and highest offer. You wouldn't be as bold as to have expressions of interest style campaign in a buyer's market. You're very nervously and carefully working with every buyer and making sure they actually just put in an offer that's semi-reasonable.
So if we're coming towards the end, but if we have a little look at the years where it wasn't so strong, so the busts, 2008, negative growth of 4.1%, weighted average across the capital cities. Now that was the GFC. 2018, negative 5.5%. Now that was largely driven by macroprudential regulation. The Banking Royal Commission and therefore consumer sentiment was impacted there. And then the COVID year when everything was going to cave in. How much negative did we have that year? Oh, no, hang on. It was positive. 4.3%. So what do we note of the two bust years and the COVID positive growth year?
Well, credit played a huge part.
Yeah.
Availability of credit and lending policy. We know that GFC was very scary and people didn't know what to expect, and the news from overseas was frightening. But we also know that lenders were clamping down. We'd gone from low doc and no doc lines. I remember 104% options for people.
106% as well.
Yeah. And within a space of a week, those were off the table, and then they were cutting maximum LVRs. And I remember self-employed dropped to 80%. It was a really tough period where credit policy pivoted overnight and people did get scared, and a lot of people couldn't borrow even if they wanted to.
100%. And then in 2011, we also had a negative year of 4.4%, which I should note as well. So, Pete, you touched on that's when the stimulus wound up.
Yeah, so a lot of the money had already been spent by then. So there wasn't a lot of this free money, in quotation marks, that wasn't around. So the market slowed down everywhere, even in Sydney. It wasn't one of Sydney's worst years, but every capital city had negative property prices in 2011.
Now, you touched on a couple of weeks ago a conversation you were having with one of your colleagues about what you thought drove the property market versus what he thought.
Yeah.
You said sounded like it was a pretty interesting debate.
Look, I do respect him greatly, but I think, and it'd be great to do the research. Like Kate mentioned before, we got the lowest interest rates ever. But I don't think our boom this time around will be as great so far as percentage property price increase is concerned as compared to 2003. I reckon off the top of my head, interest rates must have been like, I don't know, 7-8% back then. I've actually been doing a PIPA, Property Investment Professionals Australia, release very soon, which was prompted by the discussion I had with a professor at work about the impact of interest rates on property prices. And in 2002 and 3, where we had our biggest property price increases, is where we had our highest interest rates. So what I did was looked at a period of where interest rates didn't move at all and what happened to property prices. So there were three different periods in the last 20 years. If you like, I can talk some more about that next week because I don't have the information in front of me. But I agree. I think interest rates played a huge role, the major role in property prices in the past. But I don't think that's so much the case anymore.
One of the two points you made was consumer sentiment. And maybe that's that final piece when whatever the different components of the environment or the climate that come together to grow the flower in the garden, the the final one that shows or confirms the blossoming is a consumer sentiment. I'd be really interested if you could actually look through and see the consumer sentiment leading in and how it moved, leading into the booms and the busts.
That'll be some good research. So see if, what sort of correlation, we would assume a causation, but certainly a correlation between consumer sentiment and property prices. That'll be a good one for a later
episode. That's a great one. That's a new episode.
Yeah. Oh, and in the garden, we can't forget those bloody little bugs that can come and do some damage as well. You know, we can't forget those.
Who are they, the politicians? Or
Well, they did in 2018, didn't they? When it was higher interest rates for investors than it was for owner-occupiers, and borrowing money became a very forensic exercise. You had to look through your credit card statements and your bank statements with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah.
Those little bugs.
The government certainly plays a part in the ups and downs. Before we move into our gold nuggets, is there any last words?
I just think the property market is a multifaceted market, and you can't just hang your hat on one thing to say, if this one thing happens, then this will happen. That would be a good gold nugget. Now I've got to think of another one.
My yeah, you God. Do.
It's a great point, Pete. A good reminder. The property market is like a micro version of the broader economy. There's so many inputs and outputs. It's hard to pick a winner or time the market, which we've done a whole episode on. So if anyone wants to go back and listen to that episode. Well, look, it's been another great conversation with you both, some great insights, and I can't wait to hear your gold nuggets.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
What's your gold nugget for the day, Kate?
I think this exercise has highlighted the importance of two really critical things that I associate with successful property investing. The first one is long-term. It is a big picture outlook, and if you're trying to time markets, it can be really difficult. And we've seen a lot of diversity across the states and, you know, with all of these figures that Pete's put together. Now, the other one is about spreading your risk. And I think diversification is always something that can aid a multi-property investor. And this goes to show that while some states were doing really well, others were having a bit of a hard time. And if you had different eggs in different baskets, you'd be pretty happy about that.
Great gold nugget, Kate. And I remember when every man and his dog was going to buy in Perth. And, you know, they've been paying a price for a decade. Peter, what about your gold nugget? Don't call you Peter very often.
No. He's
in trouble.
That's right. So my gold nugget is, if you're going to be buying investment property, you need to be talking to a number of different professionals because there are so many factors that impact on the property market. Talk to your buyer's advocate. Talk to your strategic mortgage broker. Talk to your accountant because, you know, for example, I mean, the classic example is here in South Australia, and I'm pretty sure many other states have had it. When the land tax system changes, then that has a big impact on investors, not so much owner-occupiers, but investors. So that can also impact on the behaviour of investors. So finance, tax, the purchase of the property through your buyer's advocate, all of these people are very important to help you make your decision where you buy and what you buy.
100%. Great nugget. And your property planners. Well, another great episode, I think, guys. Thanks for bringing that awesome data to the table, Pete. And it was more in deference saying Peter, like the professor, you know. Look forward to next week's episode and hopefully our weekend lockdown goes,
fingers crossed,
think it goes okay, and the numbers start to come down for Melbourne and Sydney.
Thanks very much, Dave. Thank you, Kate. Look forward to seeing you next week.
See you next week.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about the property cycles and the economic factors which impact them, take a listen to episode 12, Property Cycle Management. Why now is always the best time to buy if it suits your personal economy and you have a long-term property plan. Episode 19, time in the market versus timing the market. Episode 42, dissecting 10 years of CoreLogic data, capital cities and regional areas. And episode 46, market update, recovery lessons from recent recessions, the Great Depression, GFC and Spanish flu.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.